Hello again. This is another episode where we are catching up with sheep farmers from around the world, part of the Global Sheep Producers Next Generation program. Today we are meeting Olivia Ellis, based in Hawke's Bay, New Zealand. She's the operations manager for Kelso Genetics, and as always, we talk all things sheep. What her role entails at Kelso, all things future farming, from genomics to markets, to as much as we don't like it, that it sometimes is important to see lamb from other countries on shelves. Hello, thank you so much for joining us. Full disclosure to anyone listening, we've also spent quite a few days together at Lambex, so we know each other and the conversation I think will flow quite well. Well, it certainly did when we were together in person. I think we're both quite chatty, but over to you. Introduce yourself, Liz.
Hi, I'm Olivia Ellis. I'm from Central Hawke's Bay, which is on the east coast of the North Island of New Zealand, and I am working for Kelso Genetics, which is a composite sheep stud.
Now, I'm going to hit you with a hard one first. I almost forgot to ask Hamish this one, the fellow New Zealander on this podcast series. Describe yourself in three words.
Oh, well, I would have been happy if you did forget that one, but passionate, focused, I guess, and then fun. I definitely think life's too short not to have fun.
Love that. Now, Kelso Genetics, tell us a little bit more about these guys. How long have you been there? Their business model. I believe you, have a really cool role with that team.
Yeah, so I joined Kelso Genetics as their operations manager just over 3 years ago now. We're a family-owned company. There's three of us that work day-to-day in the business. So Kelso goes back to the 1970s when the founder, Roger Marshall, pioneered or introduced the composite sheep breed into New Zealand. So this had a massive impact on the fertility and growth rate and meat yield of the New Zealand sheep. And so Hamish Bibby, he runs the breeding program on his family farm, and Matt Holden, he runs people and marketing. And then I came into the business as they were growing rapidly and they needed support. So I came in as operations, slotting into the middle of them and help out where I can. So my job would be a mix probably between two-thirds on farm, which is performance recording the livestock and the stud stock, and then would be an even split between on the road and in the office. So when I'm out on the road, we're out visiting current clients or potential new clients, just developing or continuing those relationships. And then, organising ramp sales, and just the general office work of the operations role. So I'm very fortunate that I do get to see all aspects of the business, and I do attend board meetings and whatnot. No 2 days are the same for me. Can't really predict what my plan, each week's going to look like, hugely dependent on weather too. So Kelso, we aim to help our commercial farmers to produce like a high-performing, efficient sheep that requires low input. So it's pretty hard to come by the perfect sheep. So, we're still trying to breed the perfect all-rounder sheep. We'll suit different environments and, bring real and long-lasting value to the commercial flock. So we've probably got about 3,500 stud ewes that split probably 60-40 between maternal and terminal sheep. The composite, you could typically say we are a bit like of a Romtex, a Romney Texel in the maternals, and a bit like a Suftex in the terminals, trying to get the best of each breed and hopefully leave the worst of each breed behind.
Now, I want to touch on a word you used there for, say, any broadacre farmers or just anyone listening to composite. It's a word commonly used. What does that actually mean? Explain it to us.
So typically, pretty much it's just crossbreeding, but it's a stabilized crossbred sheep. So you've gone through the first cross where you see massive genetic gain, and then the second cross, generally you see a big drop in production. And then as you start heading out to the third and fourth and the final cross, is that's when you become a stabilized composite. And that's where you'll start seeing your general production levels.
No. And now a little bit on you. Did you always want to work in ag? How did you end up with Kelso? I know there's a pretty cool story around this. I believe you've seen a fair bit of the world. No, so tell us about yourself and where you grew up.
So I grew up on a family intensive sheep, beef, and cropping farm, also here in Central Hawke's Bay. So I guess from an early age, I knew what the involvement was working alongside my family during school and university holidays, and it still continues today on the odd weekend. And I remember when I was telling my parents when I was quite young that I wanted to be a vet because I loved animals so much. And although I probably have them to thank for this, they sort of constantly reminded me that I wanted to be on the proactive end of animals and farmers rather than the reactive end of dealing with sick and broken animals and probably farmers that don't want to pay the bills. So, yeah, from there, I went on to Lincoln University, which is the agricultural university in Canterbury, New Zealand. My brother went there and I thought he was having quite a bit of fun, so, and probably too much fun. So I decided that was going to be a perfect fit for me. And yeah, from there, I studied a Bachelor of Agricultural Science with first class honours, which was focusing on animal genetics. And that's probably where the first sort of love for genetics came in. From my first role out of uni, I spent a couple of years working for one of New Zealand's largest meat processors, Ansco Foods. I was the agribusiness developer and farm quality assurance manager there. So, working with farmers and livestock reps, just developing relationships between those and the customers to grow and secure livestock supply. And then, yeah, as you said, I spent a couple of years overseas gaining many life skills during my OE in the UK. So, I was working on farms in England and Scotland, as well as traveling all throughout Europe, the UK, and some of Africa. So yeah, had an itch to scratch, but that itch sort of hasn't disappeared. It is something I'd definitely recommend to anyone to go overseas and get that life experience. Yeah, I really loved my time traveling, and I still have managed to have, yeah, 10 weeks overseas last year alongside working for Kelso. So I'm very lucky there.
We've interviewed farmers from England, but nobody from Africa. So, what did you do exactly there? That's cool.
Well, there's not a lot of grass for sheep to eat in Africa. When I was in Egypt, they were actually picking through rubbish bins the sheep. So I'm not sure if you will find many farmers to interview, but yeah, it was more just traveling throughout those countries. Yeah, Morocco and Egypt and things like that. So
Oh, so what weren't playing with too many sheep while you were there, just keeping an eye out for them.
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What is it you love? So you mentioned genetics, you fell in love with genetics at uni, but like, what is it you love about the industry and what is it you love about genetics?
Yeah, I love being outdoors, I guess. Like, I probably didn't realize that until you were sort of cooped up in your university classroom, that I just loved being out on the farm, dealing with the animals firsthand. Genetics, I found it really intriguing, and I probably learned more about the human body through sheep genetics than I would have in the past. But it's just fascinating. Learning how you can make progress in things that might not necessarily be able to be fixed elsewhere. For example, drench resistance in New Zealand is it's a major issue at the moment, and there is no other drenches at this stage being created to fix the problem. And so we are sort of at the end, at a bit of a dead end, really. So we need to work on how we manage that those livestock, but also we can breed for worm resistance. So worm resistance is when an animal will use antibodies to fight off the worm population in its stomach and will deposit infertile larvae onto the pastures. And so they're working to kill off the worms rather than relying on a drench. So that's been a big focus for Kelso Genetics in the last 3 years. I mean, when I started, the big talk was around facial eczema, which is an animal disease here when spores, like fungal spores, deposit onto the soil and end up on the poor quality pastures. When sheep ingest them, their liver becomes well, it's toxic to the liver, and so then they become photosensitive. You'll have subclinical problems first where you don't actually know that you've got bad scanning rates, probably because of facial eczema, or you'll have clinical where the animal's distressed. It's, you know, the hair is peeling off its face and it just wants to find shade, and it will eventually result in death. We can also breed for that, for facial eczema tolerance. So, but yeah, within the last 3 years, everyone's sort of, we've had two really wet years in New Zealand, and people have gone a little bit quiet on facial eczema because you need a hot, humid climate for that. And the water, the rain has washed off all those toxic spores. And then, yeah, so since then, two really wet years, and that's just really induced the worm population and heightened a problem that's a problem that has, let's say, been brewing for years, but has only just come out with the climate. So yeah, it is, it's really exciting when you can work in the genetic space and you can help make changes. Well, and as I said before, be on a bit more of a proactive end for farmers, helping improve their, you know, their livestock before it becomes a huge issue.
I've never really thought of it like that, but that's so true, isn't it? And I think that leads into my next question quite well. So farming in New Zealand, it's obviously, New Zealand's actually, it's not as big as Australia, but it's quite varying. What's it like over there for you guys, markets, just general consensus, and what are some challenges?
Yeah, so I'd probably have to say that, well, there's obviously lots of challenges, but the one that's sort of front of mind for me would be the profitability of sheep farming. Market prices for sheep, well, mutton and lamb are low. The price for wool is low. I mean, maybe for 2 months this year, people might have just made a profit on their shearing, but generally speaking, it's an animal health expense now. And then, you know, inflation, interest rates, and product prices are really high. So, yeah, for farmers, it's probably not, it hasn't been a great couple of years in terms of sheep farming. It's been really difficult for people. So I think people, especially worms, again, added to this, people were transitioning out of, well, not completely out of sheep, but they're definitely adding more beef cattle into their farming systems to change the ratio. So that's, you know, that has an impact on the sheep industry. We've had declining sheep numbers pretty much every year for quite a long time now. So in terms of the sustainability of the industry, it's a tricky one. But I mean, going to Lennox this year, you know, they were very positive, talking great prices, $10 a kilo for the lamb. So I think if, you know, and we do sort of follow along Australia. So yeah, that's exciting to hear that. But again, you guys have also had a really tough 2 years climatically, financially. So yeah, it was really refreshing to see. I guess some people, I think now this sort of generation coming through, like talking to Hamish Best the other day, that's where people are trying to add another layer to their business so that they can have, you know, multiple income streams or a bit more of control into the market. So yeah, it is a tricky one, but yeah, there's hope for the industry yet.
Yeah. And what, when you're having conversations with your clients or other people in the industry and they say, I'm thinking about cutting down or I'm thinking about getting out, you know, how, what do you say to them? Because there's, it's more than just financial reasons people are in sheep. You know, it value adds to their overall enterprise. You know, for us, we have a lot of stubble country here after broadacre cropping. So we know, run sheep, spray less over summer. You know, what's the type of conversations you have around that?
Yeah, it is a tricky one, and it is dependent on where they are farming. New Zealand, the landscape of New Zealand farms are very different. Sheep can graze places where some cattle can't go, you know, steep hill country farms. You probably won't want to put a cow on side of that hill as it's a long way down for her. But yeah, for our clients, generally speaking, they are reasonably settled in that, but they are, because of the profitability of sheep at the moment, they are just trying to take rams through another season, which is definitely understandable. But it then becomes a bit of a flow-on effect that, you know, if you get less rams than you typically normally would each year, you'll end up having a higher influx of, well, you know, your culling rate of rams in a few, like 3 or 4 years' time will be reasonably high, and then you're having to, you're having to bring in more rams than you normally would in a typical year. So yeah, trying to be consistent is the key. Also, I think within the sheep industry, if we look back, you know, 20 years ago, we're probably producing the same amount of meat products as we are today, but with a lot less sheep. So in terms of the genetic gains we've been making in the sheep industry, it's still a great industry for those guys to be part of.
No, I think diversification, we can't underestimate that. There's still a place for that, spreading the risk. And what's obviously, so it's, you know, it's not tough, but it's been not a fabulous couple of years in New Zealand. But what are the sheep markets there? Like, what's the lamb market? I believe you guys are also big lamb eaters compared to, say, the States, where at Lambex we spent some time with farmers from all over the world. You know, what are your main markets? It's different for you guys, but like for the commercial guys, and for those who might not have listened to Hamish's podcast episode, which was earlier on, for that side of it, what's it like, you know, for a sheep farmer over in New Zealand?
Yeah, so we probably would be making around $7.50 a kilo at the moment for our lamb. Most of that meat is exported overseas, so the heavier carcasses generally are going into North America. The UK would be sort of middle-of-the-road carcasses, and the Middle East for the lighter carcasses. Again, we are talking lighter carcass weights than you would see typically in Australia. Asia, they're a great market for our lower quality cuts of meat, the sort of cuts that we probably actually wouldn't eat ourselves. And then New Zealand probably gets what's left over. But in terms, we're still, although we're not necessarily supplying the market directly with Kelso, we, all of our clients are. And so for us, it's a big driver. Our terminal rams need to be high growth, high meat. And so they're out the door quickly before, you know, worms become an issue, facial eczema kicks in. So it's still really important for us that, you know, if our clients are winning, then we're winning.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, lamb percentage, and so what's some biggest challenges around like lambing rates, farming, for your clients?
Typically, we would be lambing around 145-150%, and that can be, you know, there can be huge ranges within just the same region. Rainfall, climate, snow, it's all, yeah, we're hugely dependent on the weather in terms of our survival rates. We've had a really great spring here in Hawke's Bay. It's actually currently snowing in the South Island. Hopefully they haven't quite started lambing yet, but we've had a really good spring. We typically don't have predators. Sometimes there are areas near forestry that will have wild pigs that have a go at the newborn lambs, but also, you know, sometimes sheep can't actually count, which is really handy. Sometimes they'll have two lambs and run off with one. So, yeah, that's typically, comparing ourselves to the guys and the girls that we met overseas, I sit there, and for yourselves, like I sit there thinking, gosh, you guys have predators like coyotes, wild dogs, foxes, grizzly bears. Like, why would you even farm if that was the case? You know, like I wouldn't be seen there. But then again, people are sort of sitting there listening to us talking about facial eczema and they think, what? Why would you farm in those sort of conditions? So, yeah, it was so interesting learning about everyone's different enterprises across the world. It was actually quite surprising too, I guess, when we were at Lamex, the amount of lamb that we ate in a three-day conference was pretty much the average North American consumer would eat in a year. Like, that just blows my mind.
Would that have been one of your biggest takeaways, or what, you know, what did you, and from Lamex itself, but also from spending a week with sheep farmers from around the world?
It probably added up to the main takeaway. You know, I was aware that sheep sort of farms so diversely around the world, but it probably widened my perception more. Although we do experience very similar challenges and opportunities, but sometimes they can be quite different too. Yeah, the people, I guess we had such a great time overseas. You know, it's not often every day that you get to meet sheep farmers from around the world. I think both the farm tours, of course, and the people that we met along the way are what truly makes those trips go from good to great.
No, absolutely. And I think we can't, I say it all the time and I say it in these podcast episodes, but like not underestimating the power of networking. Because so for you guys, so yourself and Hamish, there's a program. How did you get involved in the LAMEX? Get your ticket to LAMEX?
Yeah, so it was a program funded by Beef and Lamb. They advertised it, I think, late last year. And, yeah, you had to apply for it. You had to be a young sheep farmer and just, yeah, really sticking your teeth into the industry. You went through an interview process. And then from there they picked, two candidates, Hamish Best and I.
There are many organisations like that in New Zealand. And, like, is there strong networking opportunities for young people, like young sheep farmers? Is that a thing? So here in WA, we have AgConnect WA or NextGen. What have you guys got over there? Is it quite social being a young person in ag?
Yeah, so Beef and Lamb is funded by levy payers, which is that levy comes in at the meatworks as a per head price. Then the wool levy actually was... the farmers opted to out of the wool levy back in 2009. So in terms of that, Beef and Lamb is our main body. They are great at research extension activities. Like in terms of your region, there will always be a Beef and Lamb event on about, you know, the hot topics that are on. That's a great way to network with other like-minded farmers. There's young farmers clubs, but in terms of, we probably don't have the groups as much as you guys do.
No, that's interesting. So it makes it even more important, I suppose, being able to meet young people and doing what we did through the Global Sheep Forum. Because how many of us? There was quite a few
about
of us.
13.
Yeah. And part of it is doing a presentation. What's your topic on for the presentation?
Yeah, so I've been put in a group with an ambassador from Western Australia and then from North America. We are looking at revitalizing the wool industry. It's been quite interesting actually being put into these little research groups, because not only did you talk about it in the small conversations over in Australia, but, you know, before we probably all came together, you sort of had in your head that my own country's got the best lamb and my own country's got the best wool and we've got the best product. When in reality, we actually all have great products. So, yeah, in our group, we're looking at revitalizing the wool industry. All of our wool industries are finding it really tough. So rather than competing for our wool to be everywhere, we should probably be collaborating and working together a bit more about educating consumers worldwide to make that mindful decision to buy wool. Or a natural fibre rather than the fossil fuel-based synthetic. So, yeah, it's been really interesting, actually. Like in the 1960s, the world market of textile fibres was made up of 95% natural fibres, so wool and cotton, and then 4.5% oil-based synthetics. And, like, since then, with the rise of fast fashion and the synthetic industry, polyester holds now the market share of 54%, and only 15% of that is recycled, whereas animal products only make up 1%. So, like, we've lost all of that market share, but, like, how can we get that market share back is probably where we're trying to focus the end of our research on. And I guess it's probably looking into the younger generation. Our generation and below were probably born into an industry where plastic was quite common. Whereas, you know, our grandparents were born into an industry where plastic wasn't probably around. So how do we sort of flip it back on its head and make people realise, like, making those more conscious decisions on what they're buying? I mean, wool's 100% natural, biodegradable, temperature regulating, like all of these great qualities. So it's just, how do we reinvent the wheel? Nick Jolly, actually from Beef and Lamb, was saying when we were overseas, he said, you know, if wool wasn't around and then all of a sudden someone had just invented it in today's society, it would go gangbusters. You know, like, so how do we make that happen?
So what's the answer? What have you come up with?
So we haven't really got a golden ticket. But yeah, you know that Walmart campaign where will not fossil fuel, of that person hopping out of the Olympic sized swimming pool full of oil? That was a really effective ad globally. So I think if we could collaborate as countries rather than compete having our fiber on the world stage, come together in terms of spending money, investing into marketing campaigns like that, so people do become more conscious, more knowledgeable about the product that they're buying, and so that, yeah, they realize that they are buying the best fiber in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we are definitely seeing like New Zealand lamb on the shelf supermarket, like, get that off there.
Part of that trip, it's pretty much all you think about, you know. Yeah. We don't want Australian pork over here, but at the end of the day, having that meat on the shelf is better than not having it at all.
Yeah. So, well, I think one of the Americans touched on it, and he felt like that about Australian lamb, but then realised, because they're such small lamb eaters, they need the lamb. They could never, ever fill the current demand, which I think it's only like less than 2% of the meat consumed over there. So that's why they need Australians over there to give everyone a taste of lamb, so they're able to grow their flock numbers and grow the demand for lamb. So it's very intertwined. Like, unfortunately, I'd say from a Food Miles perspective, but fortunately, I suppose there's a place for us all. Well, I'll lead that straight into the next question. Now, I want to know your goals for the future, I suppose, is, you know, within Kelso, but also your goals as an individual within the industry.
In all honesty, I actually don't set myself any big goals. I probably prefer to have the outlook of, you know, taking any opportunity as it sort of arises. Ultimately, I would like to end up running my own farm and business. Fortunately, my parents have worked hard enough, generally our future, which we're really appreciative of, and there is opportunity there. And also with Kelso, there's opportunity there as Kelso owns the livestock and, yeah, end up paying grazing to Hamish, who's the stud manager. So Hamish did kindly offer that he would help out and shift aside if that ever did become available. So, yeah, it's definitely it's a industry that I was, growing up in, passionate about, and I sort of don't see a future without it. So,
yeah. And just for the future of the sheep industry, I suppose, in New Zealand overall, do you have any thoughts on that? I know this is basically Hamish Best's interview as well, but talking to him, he's developed this meat brand, so he's marketing directly to the consumer. Do you think we'll see more of that?
Yeah, I think we will see more of that. I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen Clarkson's Farm, but it's the funniest show, and I'm not sure if I'm biased because I am a farmer, but he's done a world of good for the sheep industry. Well, in terms of farming altogether, you know, he's helped bring the city to the farm, essentially. So, yeah, I think we will see more of that. I love the idea when I was in the UK, farm shops, where people could, you know, come out of town and come to the farm shop and buy all local produce.
I think that's farmers' markets. I know the English fellas were saying they don't have farmers' markets because they have the farm shops. What does it sort of look like over there for you guys?
Okay. So we do have farmers' markets generally on the weekend. Farm shops probably aren't really a thing here yet. I think in terms of New Zealand, our population, which is not a bad thing, I actually love it that it's quite small. So, you know, if you did open up a farm shop, you really would have to be on one of the main highways to get that business because, yeah, we still have very small rural communities around here where, you know, the main street looks quite tired and, yeah, a lot of shops have shut up. So, yeah, it is something for the future, but.
Yeah, similar to Western Australia, very common, like just it's normal to have a small town with empty shops. That's just the reality of, unfortunately. How do you guys go for like access to vets and medication and stuff like that for your sheep?
Yes, is this the topic that you guys are working on?
Yes, it is actually.
You could probably give a better answer than I could, but we are very lucky where we are. We've got really good access to vets and medication. Our vets are very successful in terms of they've got a very large business, and we do have lots of young ones wanting to come through here. But I think in the general consensus of vets in New Zealand, they are struggling for numbers. A lot of females coming through into the industry with vets, but I guess also that comes along with that is that one point in their lives they might want to start a family and, yeah, they end up leaving the clinics. So, yeah, they are battling for numbers, but in terms of Hawke's Bay, we're very lucky that we've got a good team.
Yeah, it's not something because I, where I am very lucky to have a great local vet. But then I didn't, as we did our research, there was a link here in Australia between population decline and access to vets for sheep farmers. So it's something I'm really interested in. Yeah. Now,
yeah, looking forward to hearing your presentation in a couple of weeks.
I know. Have you got anything else to add before I go into the buzzwords?
Go on, hit me with these buzzwords.
All right. So I'm going to finish off with some hot topics or buzzwords, whatever you want to refer to them as. EIDs. I believe this is a huge part of Kelso's business.
Yes. EIDs, we are heavily reliant on our EIDs, so heavily reliant that we actually have one EID tag and then we also tag with a visual tag. This visual tag doesn't actually have to be seen in the paddock, but it's just a backup in case the EID tag falls out. So for us, everything associated with that electronic identification is when we measure their performance, whether that's weight gain, eye muscle area, and also when we've got our DNA results, we'll be adding parentage and putting pretty much all of our performance data against the animal to create a lifetime history. I know it's becoming mandatory in Australia. It's not here in New Zealand for commercial farmers, but I can see for people that it is an added cost and it's a change to the industry. But I guess once you get a handle on the technology, there's so many things that you can record on your own farm, and that way you can make more informative decisions. So, for example, culling your ewes or preg scanning, you can put their data in, weight gains, and then ultimately making those decisions based on all that data, you can create your own genetic gain in your own flocks. So at Kelso, we tag with an EID tag and a visual tag at docking, and then from there we'll take a DNA sample, which is just like a little hole punch out of their ear. And we've been doing that since probably the early 2000s. And then from there, we'll send that DNA sample away, and we should, depending on how organized I am, we should get that data back by weaning. And all of that is matched to their EID. And everything that we, in terms of our data that we collect, we send it away to an independent agent. We call them a SIL, Sheep Improvement Limited Bureau. And so they input all of your data. As soon as you lose a tag, if you lose an EID tag, you can put a blank one in, but you send all of that through to them. And yeah, so from DNA, we can pretty much work out their parentage. We don't have to tag at birth. We can do that all at docking, and especially in terms of the numbers that we deal with. And also it's all on hill country farms. So going out trying to chase a lamb on the hill country is probably not the best use of your time. And then, yeah, you can have single gene tests done. So, for example, the double mussing gene out of Texels or Scrapie, which is important for us in terms of exporting animals, well, sheep to the UK, infertility and things like that.
And for your clients, your commercial guys, are you seeing more of them get into EIDs, and what are they using their data for?
Very little of our clients, there'd just be a small handful probably using, well, that we're aware of, that are using EIDs. I mean, one of our clients, he's measuring foot scores on all of his rams when he comes to pick his rams, and then they'll continue measuring that through. So I guess with EIDs and data, it's probably the data is only as good as, unless you use it, you know, if it's just written down on paper and you're not doing anything about it, it's really a waste of your time. But there's actually so much that you can do with that. Yeah, so there's huge potential. And again, it's not here, it's not in New Zealand really yet. But I mean, if that's headed for you guys, then it probably won't be too far away for us.
Mm. Next buzzword, genomics.
Genomics probably leads on a bit from my DNA that I mentioned before. So Genomic selection combines both your phenotype, which is like your physical, and then genotype, which is like your genetic markers or DNA, and that will then provide breeding values. So we at Kelso, we get these breeding values and we create an index from it while putting on an economic weighting. So that's based off what the industry thinks the economic weighting should be. So, you know, reproduction's important, growth's important, things like that. So genomic selection, I guess it enables you to make decisions early in age of an animal's life. So, and especially on hard to measure traits or expensive traits. So when we submit their DNA at docking time, you'll get it all back by weaning. And in that way, you can make decisions early about culling an animal based on what their genomic values would be. You'll be able to see the genetic potential of that lamb and how he or she will perform when they're older, rather than grazing that animal right through till they're a two-tooth or a one-year-old, and you've just fed that mouth, you know, you've fed that sheep unnecessarily when you could have made that decision a lot sooner. So at Kelso, we've been part of the South Island Genomic Calibration Progeny Trial, and the purpose of this progeny trial is set out to test how closely related an animal's DNA profile matches the performance in real life. So in this case, testing the genomic predictability behind meat eating quality measures, such as meat tenderness, pH, intramuscular fat, and colour. And that actual carcass performance of the lambs is compared to what their DNA predicts. So for us at Kelso, we're breeding rams for commercial farmers and keeping our ewe lambs for replacements. We can't send a line of lambs to the works to measure this. So we, without this progeny trial, there wouldn't be a way for us to collect that data. And, you know, from this trip to South Australia with the global sheep producers, I ended up picking up Hamish Best as a client because we've got meat quality rams that were entered in these progeny trials to collect that data. He's coming along so that when he produces his meat for his butcher trailer in Wellington, there'll be beautiful cuts of meat.
Not biased at all.
Yeah.
Next one, I've thrown in here because I saw a really cool picture of another trial that you guys are doing, or maybe it's linked to the trial we just spoke about, but measuring methane. Explain what that photo is that you sent through to us and, what's going on there.
Ag Research has been working on creating a methane index. Depending on what the government chooses to do, we've been measuring this since the trial began in 2019, I think. Essentially, we test about 160 to 200 ram hoggets that will be up for sale in the springtime. They go in for, I mean, as time's evolved, the timing's changed, but we put them in for about 40 minutes and measure it 0 minutes, 20 minutes and a 40 minutes of their methane and carbon dioxide. And from there, we have to test about 20 ram lambs per sire so that you get a valid data set. And from there, we have not got it included in our custom index, but it is there. We've got history based on the data of which rams emit higher methane and which rams emit less methane. But I guess with genetics, it's really important to have the history on the data so that when you do need to make decisions on it, you can based on good, valid data.
Wow, I love that. And the photo, I don't know how to explain it, but they were basically in these little...
Yes. So they're in methane chambers. There's about 12 that go in at a time, and they've got this little glass door that they can look out if they want. And, I mean, it's totally safe and a great process because I guess you're measuring their carbon dioxide, so you can see if they're stressed and they can always be let out early, but none of the ram lambs were let out early this year. So, it's amazing what technology's out there. And I think from that, Ag Research has sold numerous methane trailers around the world. So, it's pretty cool to be an industry that is forefronting some things, but also when we came over to Australia, it's amazing to see how much money is put into research into the agricultural industry in Australia.
No, I think people always argue there's not enough, but in a way we are very lucky. In other countries, that's for sure. Now, worm-wise, we touched on it earlier on in the podcast, but worms, it's a hot topic in New Zealand, so I'll give it a minute of its own. I don't know how you can summarise it, though, but what are you doing? How can we overcome this?
Yeah, so worm-wise is a program that's it's funded by Beef and Lamb New Zealand. And we've got Ginny Dudunsky, who is our Wormwise program manager, and she is amazing. You could listen to her for 2 hours and she won't mention the word drench. So I guess, yeah, we've got lots of research. Well, not research. We've got lots of articles and the website Wormwise. You'll be able to find that on the Beef and Lamb website. It's got amazing information on how to tackle those issues, but it's also about understanding the worm cycle and what sort of worms will be in what sort of season. So, yeah, big focus on grazing management. You know, it used to be in New Zealand that the lambs were on the flat country and the ewes were on the steep hill country, but it's about rotating those around because, as I've learned, ewes ingest worm larvae and they will only deposit about 5% of fertile larvae. So they're a great mopping up machine of worms, and especially the resistant worms. So yeah, there's lots of little things that people can be doing, and it's a really big topic to cover. I definitely couldn't do it in a minute, but yeah, there is ways out of it. There is farmers that have had triple drench resistance and have managed their way out of it. So there is still a bright future for worms.
For worms. I love it.
Yeah, you don't think you're going into farming when you, well, you're going into sheep farming, but you don't think you're going into worm farming as well.
Yeah, no. All right. Anything else you have to add?
No, I think it was an amazing opportunity being able to, you know, come over to Australia, meet other young sheep producers from across the globe and to be able to network with each other and, you know, gain those relationships, because I feel like relationships like those will always be there. And, you know, if you are ever traveling overseas, there's opportunities that you can go look at farms over there. Sheep Producers Australia did an amazing job alongside the other global sheep producer partners in executing the program. They've definitely set the bar really high. So good luck to whoever's hosting it next. But yeah, I think we've had a really cool group and hopefully we can catch up at some point soon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I don't know, you're a wealth of knowledge, that's for sure. I don't know, I really, really enjoyed, as a sheep farmer, spending that time with you and learning from you. So thank you for today.
Right back at you, Tiff.
Thank you again to Liv. I know I'm inspired by your knowledge and your passion. Keep an eye out for the next episode, catching up with sheep farmers from around the world.